So hi everyone, I'm Shira, and as advertised, I'm going to talk about complexity in QFT and robotics. So a historical prelude to all the story of the complexity comes from the long-standing question of the information paradox and what's going on behind the horizon. And so one way in which people have been trying to address this question is by using the holographic perspective and trying to translate these observables that go behind the black hole horizon to field theory observables, and by that having a new tool to answer that question. That's also why I'm interested in that. But that's what led them to computational complexity, which is one of these things. So let me first define what is complexity. So quantum computational complexity of a state, it's a property of a state. It's defined as the minimal number of simple unitary operations that act on a small number of, say, qubits in a chain that are needed to reproduce the state of interest. So the complexity of a target state T is defined as the minimal number of simple operations, and I'm going to define simple in a second. That are needed to go from a simple reference state, and simple here means unentangled for without any spatial entanglement, which we will call the reference state, to our state of interest. And sometimes within some tolerance, so sometimes it's not possible to get exactly this state, and we will need to get as close as we can to it. So for example, if we think about a spin chain, a simple state could be, like the reference state, could be, say, all spins up, or any other state without spatial entanglement, meaning that the entanglement entropy is going to vanish for any spatial sub-region that we pick. And then simple gates would be simple unitaries that involve a number, a small number of qubits, one or two. So gates would involve one or two, say, qubits or spins. They will be unitary. And usually, if we are talking about spin chains, they will be taken from some simple set or a universal set, and that could contain usually Hadamard gates and controlled node gates, phase shift gates. And then the complexity is just going to be the minimal number of gates. So ideally, we would reproduce approximately our target state by acting with a unitary. And that unitary is going to be made from gates, G1, G2, Gn, acting on the reference state. And n, or the smallest number of such gates, is going to be the complexity. Minimal number of gates. And then, as I said, sometimes it's not possible, especially if our set is finite or too small, it's not possible to reproduce exactly the target state within a finite number of operations, but it's possible to get arbitrarily close to it if the set is universal, and so sometimes we will have to have a notion of tolerance. Okay, so now you see that in defining complexity, there are a lot of choices involved. We have to pick the reference state, we have to pick the gates. And so you can ask whether all these choices influence the complexity, and the answer is, of course, they do. And what we should think about complexity is, we should just like get used to thinking about it as a large family of different definitions which depend on these gates and the reference state. And of course, an unrelated question, which is also very interesting, is whether some universal data can be extracted from the complexity. And universal data, so certain properties are expected, for instance, for the complexity of fast scrambling system. And these are like a linear growth for a very long time. And then the saturation at time, which is exponential in the number of degrees of freedom. And we can also ask whether some universal information is hidden in the divergent structure of the complexity, whether we have some trace of anomalies in the, I don't know, coefficients of the log like we do in entanglement and so on. So all these are interesting questions. And at the moment that we started studying the complexity, we didn't have a good field theory definition of it. And so I'm mainly going to focus today on telling you about some progress that we and also the group by Rob made in trying to define it in field theory. But I'm also going to tell you a little bit before about the holographic conjectures. And you already know by now, by my introduction, that complexity is related to certain observables that go behind the horizon of a black hole. So in the context of holography, yeah, sorry.
Is there a version of this for mixed states?
I think that for mixed states, you need to add additional degrees of freedom in such a way that you purify your system, like you like making it a thermofield double, for instance, for the thermal state. And then you would think about the pure state that is defined this way as a way to define the complexity.
So I would choose a simple, the optimal circuit and the optimal purification to define the complexity.
Yes, I think so. So in holography, two proposals have been made for complexity, and both of them by the group at Stanford. So the first one is the complexity equals volume. And the proposal there is that the complexity is related to a maximal volume slice going through the bulk geometry. So for instance, for the case of an eternal black hole, which is dual to the thermofield double state, that maximal volume slice is just going to go between the two boundaries at times T left and T right. And that you can mimic for the thermofield double state by a choice of Hamiltonians on the two systems. So that's then the complexity is going to be given by just dividing the volume by G Newton and an extra length scale. And that length scale, it's not completely obvious what it is in the proposal, but it's suggested that for a large black hole, it's going to be the ADS radius. For small black holes, it's going to be the radius of the black hole. But this is a bit uncomfortable property of this proposition, and that led to an improved proposition. So this one was by Lenny and Douglas, and the alternative was by Adam and Dan and Lenny and Brani and Ying, and that's the complexity equals action. And the suggestion there is that the complexity is given by the gravitational action of a certain region in the bulk, which is bounded by light sheets. So that's going to be just the following region in the eternal black hole background. So that's going to be bounded by light sheets going from the two boundaries. So that's just going to be the gravitational action. The complexity is going to be given by this gravitational action of the width patch divided by pi and h bar. And these two properties have these two propositions have very appealing properties in the sense that they remind us of properties that we expect from complexity. So for instance, we can learn from them that the complexity grows linearly at late times at a rate which is proportional to the mass of the black hole. And in the case of the action conjecture, is related to a bound by Lloyd on the speed of computation. And that's why people say that black holes are the fastest computers in nature. There's also some traces of perturbation, which are very similar to what is expected from complexity. Namely, there is a delay in the rate of growth of complexity that we observe when we insert a perturbation to the system. And this delay is proportional in time to the scrambling time of the system. And also, there is the proposition by Brian that we should view ADS as coming from some tensor network introducing entanglement into the system. And in this picture, the volume is just counting the number of gates. So that's these are three pieces of evidence to motivate these holographic conjectures or proposals. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to review two of the properties of the holographic proposals, or actually one of the properties of the holographic proposals, that is going to be useful for me in comparing them to the field theory results that I'm going to present right after. So one property which is important from the holographic proposal and is the thing that I will be looking for in a good definition of complexity in field theory is something about the structure of divergences. So we already expect that both in the field theory side and in the holographic side, we're going to have divergences in the complexity. And in the field theory side, this is because we are introducing entanglement at very short length scale, so arbitrary short length scale that's going to result in a divergence. In the holographic picture, this is because of the region near the boundary in which the metric is, diverging. And so the way to regulate these divergences in holography is just by introducing a cutoff near the boundary, a short distance cutoff, which is matched to z equal delta in the Pfefferman-Gram expansion. And then instead of computing the volume, we're just going to compute the volume of the regularized surface. And we can study the divergences of this system. And that was done in two papers, one by Rob and Dean and Pratik, and one by Reynolds and Ross. And what they find is that the leading divergence from the volume conjecture is proportional to the central charge of the system times a volume factor and divided by the cutoff to the power of d minus 1. This is the boundary space-time dimension of the boundary. And from the action conjecture, what is found is that there is a similar divergence, but there is one even stronger divergence, which is has the same form times a logarithm. So CT is the central charge, vol is the spatial volume of the system, L is LADS, and this mu and delta is the short distance cutoff. And this alpha tilde guy is some constant which is related to the normalization of null normals. And the reason is that when we evaluate the gravitational action of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch, we have null boundaries, and these null boundaries are defined by null normals. And it turns out that a well-defined variational principle of the gravitational action can be found for any rescaling of these normals, since they don't have a natural normalization. And so the constant that enters here in defining the normalization of the boundary is the thing that ends up entering the final result for the complexity. So maybe it makes you feel a bit uncomfortable that there is some ambiguity in the definition of the complexity, but I'm going to show you that this alpha tilde is in fact mimicked very closely by a field theory choice that we make in defining the complexity. And so at the end, we were not that surprised at finding, because it matches quite well. So, okay. So I think now I'm going to move to the field theory construction. So as I told you, when we started working on that, there was not a very good definition of complexity in field theory. I mean, we're not infinitely far from that point. I mean, now we know how to define it for free field theories and only for Gaussian states. But of course, we are hoping to have a better understanding in the future. But that's a start. So first, what are the challenges in defining complexity in field theory? What do we need to choose? So we need to choose first our theory. The setup. We need to choose the states. We need to know what we expect to be a natural reference state and a target state. We need to find a natural distance function. For defining the distance of states along the circuit, and we need to know how to minimize it, so a procedure for minimizing it. And then one thing which is special in field theory is the fact that we have divergences, so we need to find a way to regulate UV divergences. So the field theory that we chose to study was a free scalar in d plus one dimensions. I'm changing my notation for d. Now d is going to be the space dimension. So with the following Hamiltonian, is an integral in momentum of a pi of k, pi of minus k, plus omega k squared, phi of k, phi of minus k. And omega k is just the frequency associated with the mode k, square root of k squared plus m squared. So that's my Hamiltonian. That's the theory that I want to study. For the states, we are focusing on pure Gaussian states, so states which are annihilated by generalized annihilation operators. So we are looking at states which are defined by some function alpha k of momentum by the following definition. So they will be annihilated by this linear combination, alpha k over 2 phi of k plus I 1 over 2 alpha k square root pi of k acting on our state of interest. That's going to vanish. So all our states are going to be states of the, annihilated by operators of this form just by with different choices of alpha k. And so, and they will have the two-point function in momentum space, which we look like that. So they will have this two-point function in momentum space, phi of k, phi of minus k, is going to be 1 over 2 alpha k, delta k plus k prime. And this choice was motivated by the states that we see in the continuous MERA networks, so in continuous multiscale entanglement renormalization assets, tensor networks, because they are very similar to the states that you see there. So first, the reference state. So the reference state is going to be the one which corresponds to alpha k, which is a constant. And that's an unentangled product state. Why is it unentangled? Because if you transform the two-point function to real space, you just get, again, a delta function in real space. And so, as a consequence, the different points don't talk to each other. So one way to picture this state, which is very natural, is to draw a plot of alpha k as a function of k. And so this unentangled product state is just going to be a state of constant m.
So for any choice of alpha, how unique is s given this condition?
How uniquely is S determined? Are there different linearly independent states that are annihilated by the same operator, for example? Well, you have, I mean, for instance, you can add a phase to your state. Oh, linearly independent.
Right.
I think within the Gaussian states, they are basically uniquely defined up to a phase because they will be an exponent of, I mean, I don't know, the way...
Okay.
I just mean that, well, they will be exponents of this phi, phi with prefactor alpha k. They're basically like products of Gaussian in momentum space, and then in the specific case of the unentangled product state, they will be also Gaussians in real space, just Gaussian for every value of x.
These states stay in the Hilbert space. For a single harmonic oscillator, they're all, you know, coherent states or circles in phase space. These are ellipses centered at the origin.
So that's the reference state. The target state which is natural, is the ground state. It has entanglement in subset spatial regions. It has alpha k equals to omega k. And if you just plug this alpha k inside the definition of the generalized annihilation operator, you get the usual annihilation operator of the vacuum. So that's just the ground state, and it has alpha k equals to omega k. So on this plot, it's going to look like basically a monotonic function of k. Or if that's if it's massless. If it's massive, it's going to start at m. But in any case, it's going to be a monotonic function of k. And the task that we are trying to achieve is to transform that state, which is the reference state, to that state, which is the target state. And the point is that we have infinitely many momenta to modify. So clearly, that's going to be divergent. But to regularize it, the way to regularize it is just to put a simple cutoff. And so we're just going to require that our reference state became the target state up to the cutoff, while after the cutoff, we're just going to leave it. We're not going to touch it. We're going to leave it the reference state. So that's going to be our way of regularizing the divergences. In fact, the circuit that we consider is just going to move the reference state to the approximate target state up to a cutoff lambda in momentum. And in similar circuit, they choose m to be equal to lambda, but that doesn't have to be the case. Okay, so the next thing is how will the circuit look? So in general, the circuit is going to be a path ordered exponential over a Hermitian generators taken from a finite set. It's going to transform our reference state m to our target state 0 or 0 lambda, approximately 0, by passing through a set of states in the middle, psi of sigma, which are going to be defined by acting with a certain unitary on the original state. And we want the unitary, and sigma is going to run from 0 to 1. That's just a choice for the range. And we want the unitary at sigma equals 0 to just be 1. So we don't want to modify our original state. And the unitary at sigma equals 1, we want it to exactly reproduce the target state. So we want that thing. And in general, the unitary is going to be a path-ordered exponential of generators taken from a finite set, so from 0 to sigma, g of s ds. And g's are going to be taken from some set. And so we are just laying down, in a sense, gates, which are these exponentials. Now, a natural choice that we took for the set of gates was the following. So we took our gates to be Hermitian in the span of these three guys, k0 of k, k plus of k, and k minus of k, that are defined as follows. So these are the gates. So k0 of k is defined as a bk dagger b k plus b minus k dagger b minus k. I should have said much, much, much earlier that this work was done in collaboration with Hugo Marocho, who is here, and with Fernando Pastaski, who is also here, and with Michal, who will be here next week after we all leave. So this is k0. That's k plus bk dagger b minus k dagger over 2. And k minus is b minus k over 2. And bk is the guy that annihilates the reference state. And alternatively, we could define them in terms of the a case. And the reason that we chose these gates is that we wanted to have inside our gate set the gate of CMERA that leads to that we know that leads to the ground state, and we also wanted to slightly extend this set, so we chose the smallest subset of quadratic operators that preserve momentum. So these are gates, and they form a very nice algebra. They close an algebra which is a product of different SU11s, one for each pair of opposite momenta. So that's the algebra. And then the next thing is the distance function. So the distance function, for the distance function, we chose the following one. So we suggested, at least on this subset of Gaussian states with quadratic operator, that a natural measure of distance is the Fubini-Studi metric. Which is defined basically by taking the variance of the state along the circuit. So that's going to be the following thing. It's going to be an integral from 0 to 1, which is the circuit itself, of the path variation, or the variance along the path of the state. And the reason why we suggested that as a, so then the complexity is just going to be the minimal length, minimizing over the choices of gates in the path ordered exponential of this measure. And the reason that we thought that this measure was natural was because it does not get contributions from gates which annihilate the state or just modify it by an overall phase, and that we thought was a natural property to be required from a metric. And of course, if the circuit is, I mean, it also has all the nice properties of a metric, like triangular inequalities and so on. Okay. Okay, now one way in which we can make the computation efficient is by getting rid of directions that don't modify the state or modify it only up to an overall phase. And so that's what we did. So we're going to move from this representation of the circuit with the path ordered exponential to a representation of the circuit with a different representation, which is much more natural because it mods out a lot of redundant data. And that's going to be the following. So the idea is that if we have a path order exponential of a closed algebra, we can always reunite all the different exponential into a single unitary of the same algebra. And we can alternatively also put all the k plus on the left-hand side, all the k zeros in the middle, and all the k minus on the right-hand side. And since k minus annihilates the reference state, and k zero only gives a constant, so it gives an overall phase, we're going to be able to get rid of all these redundant data. And so in general, we can represent the important part of the state up to an overall normalization by just an exponential of a prefactor function, which we will call gamma plus, times k plus of k, the generator that actually is modifying the state. And that's going to act on the reference state. So that's going to be and at every point, we're going to have a different choice of this function gamma plus, which is going to be in very complicated relation to the original coefficients in the path ordered exponential. But that doesn't really matter. So our state is just going to be given by this function gamma plus. Now we can take this representation of the circuit and plug it into the Fubini-Studi metric. So one thing that I want to say about this representation is that that's no longer a unitary because k plus dagger is not k plus. But the point is that I swallowed things which annihilate the reference state here, but I could always like pick them back from the reference state and recollect them in such a way that it will look unitary. So I mean, there are things here that I use to say annihilate or give a general an overall phase to the reference state that are not used, but they are not used to generate entanglement in the state. So they are not particularly important. And some more things that I want to say about gamma plus. So gamma plus is smaller than one by unitarity. So the requirement that I can complete this guy to a unitary requires that the absolute value of gamma plus is smaller than one, and also that gamma plus is symmetric. That's by the symmetry of the generators. And then we can take this representation of the circuit and plug it back in the Fubini-Studi metric and see what we get. And so the thing that we're going to get should look familiar. So that's what we're going to get. That's the line element of the Fubini-Studi metric along these states. It's given by the sigma square root volume over 2 b dk. And then here we're going to have gamma plus prime of k and sigma gamma plus. That's a derivative with respect to sigma. Of k sigma over 1. So what is that metric? Right, so it's just Poincaré unit disks, basically. Since gamma plus is, yeah, it's the hyperbolic plane. Since gamma plus is smaller than one, it's in the coordinate system in which it's the Poincaré unit disks. But basically the thing that we see is that the geometry that we have is if we draw it as a function of gamma plus, not of sigma, but of a specific momentum pair, k n minus k, then if that's the real part of gamma plus, if that's the imaginary part of gamma plus and that's the real part of gamma plus, then we just have the geometry of the hyperbolic plane and we know what are minimal lines on this geometry. They are basically just circles perpendicular to the boundary and lines along the diameter. So all we need to do now, since we already know everything about that geometry, is we just need to translate our reference state and target state to this language of the gamma plus. We need to know what is gamma plus of the target state and the reference state, and we're going to immediately know what are the geodesics that go between one and the other. And so answer is that, well, gamma plus of the reference state, so of M, is 0. So gamma plus of K and sigma equals 0 should be 0. So we should start at the origin. That's because when we plug here 0, we're just going to get, again, the reference state. For the target state, one needs to play a little bit of algebraic tricks to make sure that when we commute the annihilation operator of the target state, we get the one of the reference state. But this basically tells you that the gamma plus of k and sigma equals 1, so the endpoint of the circuit, is just a tangent hyperbolic of a log of square root of m over omega k. So that's the endpoint of the circuit, and that's a real number which is sitting along the diameter whose placement depends on k. So for larger k, it's just going to move closer and closer to the boundary of the circle. And so the way that we want to build our circuit is just by looking at geodesics of this plane. And so it turns out that the relevant affinely parameterized geodesics are just the following lines. So now gamma plus of k and sigma it's just going to be tangent hyperbolic of sigma log of square root of m over omega k. These are the geodesic lines. And when we plug that back into the Fubini's 2D metric, we can evaluate the length of the circuit. And what we're going to get is that the complexity is basically given by square root of volume over 2 d dk. And here, that's going to be log of square root of m over omega k squared. Now, there is a certain freedom here because we chose the sigma to be the only path parameter. And so we chose, in fact, implicitly that gates of different momenta are allowed to act simultaneously. If we were not doing that, if k was also a path parameter and we would only allow one gate per momenta to act at every point of the circuit, then our metric would look like that. The k integral is going to be pulled outside and it's just going to become another path parameter, just like sigma. And the measure for the complexity going to be this one. So actually, I can make that as an absolute value. So that's C1. And this C1 is very interesting to us because it seems to mimic very closely properties from holographic complexity. So that's the main result. That's our answer for the complexity of the ground state, starting with an unentangled product state with a characteristic scale m. Now, if we look at the leading structure of divergences in that guy, what we find is that the leading structure of divergences, well, the leading divergence is proportional to the volume times lambda to the d and times a log of m over lambda. Or if we set m equal to lambda, then the subleading divergence is going to win. And so that's when m and lambda are independent. But if they are the same, then the leading divergence is going to be volume times lambda to the d. And these are very, very similar to the things that we see in holography. So I'm going to remind you what we saw in holography just before. So what we saw in holography at the beginning of the talk was that the complexity was proportional from the volume to the central charge volume over delta to the d, well, d. Now that I changed the definition of d, and from the action it was a volume over delta to the d. The leading one was a square root of L over alpha tilde. And this cutoff. So we see that if we make the following identifications, so if we make the identification of the momentum cutoff with 1 over delta, and if we also make the identification of this alpha tilde, or say L over alpha tilde with M, then we see that we get exactly the same results. And that kind of leads us to the understanding that this alpha tilde that was a choice of the null normal normalization in holography is actually associated with a natural choice that we have to make in the field theory definition of complexity, which is m, which is the scale of the reference state. So alpha tilde, null normal normalization. Choice corresponds to choosing M. M, the scale of the reference state.
A question. My naive guess was that the L dependence, I mean the L there, is because of the IR divergence, because omega k, if it's a massless theory like a CFD, the minimum value of omega is like some 1 over length or something, the size of the box. So I think that, isn't that the reason it will be large? The complexity will be large if it's a massless CFD. Omega k is square root k square plus m square. And if m is 0, you have to do this integral dk log k, which diverges, because it log diverges. Is it that reason? Okay, I don't know what m is actually. Is your L the size of the box here?
No, so...
Where is L? Capital L.
So capital L, so that's a result that came from the holographic.
Right, so
side.
That was L there, capital
so
L.
So L is LADS, it's the radius of the ADS space.
Uh-huh.
And, well, it is related to the size of your boundary. I think that the point is that that's not by itself a quantity in the field theory side.
Yeah,
and
that may
so
be true, but I was just wondering how do you, isn't that integral divergent in for a massless theory in one dimension?
Let me think.
Dx log x from x.
Well, it's if it's times x, right? Because
x log x minus x, which converges as you take the limit.
Okay.
It's another version.
Okay.
I have a question. Your unit is where momentum space separated by momentum.
That's right.
So what that means is that when we represent the positional space, they're very special by local objects.
That's true.
I would imagine that a more natural definition of complexity would be someone like nearest neighbors.
So
what happens then?
So I think if you study, so that's not our work, that's the work by Rob, but if you study all possible bilinears without actively putting a penalty on acting with things which are further apart, you find that the most efficient way to construct your circuit is by acting with these, say, mode squeezing operators in momentum space. If you do act by hand penalty factors, then the computation becomes much, much, much more involved.
Sure.
And it's not obvious how much, simple intuition you can gain from it. But, I mean, I think if you look a little bit in like the holographic literature, it seems like what people have in mind is bilocal gates in the sense that they would act at two points, but not necessarily at two points which are much, say, closer apart, closer to one another. So, I mean, it's a question of your definition of complexity, but I agree, of course, that in a field theory definition, you also want to ask the question about locality and how it influences. But at the moment, I can't say that I have a good answer to that from the way that we study things.
Okay.
Maybe you can say that the volume that you have in this symmetric there, so this is the volume in the field theory?
Yeah, so it's basically it's a delta of zero. So I mean,
yes, but here it's somewhere in being interpreted as the volume in the ADS space.
Oh no, both of them. So both of them are volume of the boundary. They are volume of the field theory. Both volumes are just volume of the field theory. So in the holographic calculation, if you put an extra scale which say decouples the volume in the field theory from the ADS scale, you see that the thing that you have there is just the volume, basically the volume of the field theory, the boundary. Yeah, I don't know if it's a sphere in d minus y dimensions, then that's what you.
Yeah. Let's say if you have something like a wormhole, then these two things become very different.
No, yeah, of course, but I'm just saying. Okay, so
there are
two different volumes. So this volume is not the volume. Well, maybe the notation was a bit misleading. So that volume is not that full thing is the result of the volume of the wormhole divided by G and L. And if you evaluate it explicitly in, say, I don't know, empty ADS, you find that you can translate it back to field theory quantities using the central charge and the field theory volume. So
mirror as a quantum circuit, then we get the result logarithmic answer. We just have a volume.
Right.
Yeah. So what's the connection to your counting?
In between us and say mirror.
See, if we think about C mirror, that's also probability of volume.
Right. So well, I. So it, now it starts depending on which measure, but so in. So CIMERA also has, I mean, you can also take the CIMERA circuit. I mean, it has a very explicit form. It's also given in terms of these gates. And it has a gamma plus of its own. You can look at this gamma plus. This gamma plus is going to be a bit different from the gamma plus that we have in the sense that it's going to be cut off, right? Like you see that we act on all momenta. I mean, you see from here that we act on all the different momenta up to the cutoff at every point in the circuit, while the CIMERA gates, they have a cutoff, so they have a sharp cutoff. So at every point in sigma, you only act up to, say, if you want to write it in terms of the sigma, sigma is just going to be e to the u, the parameter of CIMERA. You will have gates that act up to lambda times sigma. And you can write the specific gamma plus that matches that. And the thing that you're going to get is that now it depends on your measure, but if you have a measure which is acting with all the k gates in parallel, so with the square root act over the ddk, you will get a circuit which is exactly square root 2 times longer than our circuit. So for this measure, I mean, so, and if the square root is inside, you will get exactly the same length. So for the first measure, the CIMERA circuit is actually not optimal. Our circuit is doing the work better by a factor of square root of 2. While if you are not acting with the momentum gates in parallel, you get that the two are equally long. It's a kind of a Manhattan metric thing that, I mean, you don't have to, since the different hyperbolic disks are decoupled, you don't have to match the speeds of building the state in all the different k modes, so it starts not mattering. But
other than discretized picture, if we just count number of circuits, it's like volume, scale like volume.
Yes, I mean, I think the scaling is, you would get this, I mean, you would get the same thing, just an overall.
But the divergence also, I think it's like, without the logarithmic enhancement.
Oh yeah, because in the CIMERA circuit they make the choice of right when they optimize the arrival to the ground state, the large M or the scale associated with the reference state is equal to lambda the cutoff, right? That's the most optimal. So if they choose M equals to lambda, this divergence just goes away and you're left with the next subleading one, which is just going to be which is like this, right? Because you will always have also, I mean, that's just the leading, but you will also have a term like that, that when you set m equals to lambda, that's going to drop. And
if your choice of the reference was different, then would you have another geodesic like the one? So this is one geodesic, right?
Yeah.
So if I chose some other reference.
Yeah, so I think it gives you the framework to answer this question. I mean, if you just ask, okay, with our set of gates, which is not everything that you have, you are always able to, I mean, if you give me a circuit that gets me to my state that you're interested in, I'm going to be able to tell you what's this gamma plus, and I'm going to be able to tell you what's the optimal circuit. Maybe it's not going to lie along the diameter, maybe it's just going to lie somewhere on the circle, but I will have an explicit way of computing the distance.
Well, when you consider particle spin, then we have periconnection in the momentum space. Does periconnection modify the expression for complexity?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but maybe we can like chat a little bit afterwards.
So in MERA, sometimes we can show that if you want some approximation epsilon to the state, that the complexity is at least upper bounded, but probably scales like the volume times log epsilon or log one over epsilon. Do you think there's any kind of connection here? Like this M is like making, saying you don't get the state quite right at very high momentum.
Yeah, but I'm trying to say, to understand, like, how do you measure the distance? I mean, it's clearly not a product, right? It's not a product of the two states that gives you this epsilon. What
well,
is the
it depends.
Of the epsilon?
So one definition would be if you want local observables up to accuracy epsilon, then if you want the whole state to have high overlap, then you probably need to make epsilon depend on system size, say, in some way. But if you just want the local data to be identical.
And I see.
So like volume log one over epsilon or volume log volume. Volume log volume would give you close, would give you high overlap in the thermodynamic limit. So that the would actually approach, the overlap would approach one as you take the system size to infinity.
So I think that at the end of the day, I mean, we are using different circuits, but we are constructing exactly the same state that the Chimera is constructing. I mean, except for this distinction that they are choosing M and lambda to be the same. But
yeah.
So I think that if there is a statement about local data there, I mean, it must be correct here because it's the same state.
Yeah, this is actually a statement about discrete Chimera.
Oh, I see.
As opposed to, I mean, probably there's something similar there. But so I wonder if you have thought about approximation in this. Like if I don't want to get the actual state, but only epsilon close to it in whatever measure, whether that epsilon enters a log or not, or how it enters the expression.
Is it possible to study sublinear divergences now that you have the leading ones?
Yeah, so you can have, I mean, you can write down the sublinear divergences. They're going to be a series in terms of, say, I don't know, your small mass. Usually, you can have an exact result for that guy for the case of a massless theory. And that result is going to contain a factor like that, a factor like that, and a constant. Then you can also expand in terms of, say, mass times the cutoff. The addition, like if you have a massive theory, you're just going to get a series of corrections in jumps of two, I think, like the usual thing.
Let's consider the massless case. Can it be matched to submitting divergences in holographic prediction? Because in a entanglement entropy context, we can match the, for example, the log coefficient universal term, even dimensions, for example, and try to check the coefficient in the Lutakian algebra description. Here, can we possibly check the pi coefficient in the for example, the complexity before satchel?
So the other thing, well, I can tell you two things. One thing is that the exact prefactors of the, say, next subleading divergence doesn't match the one of holography. Like, you don't get exactly the same dependence on the dimensions and so on. So that's one thing. The second thing is that about the coefficient of the log, well, one thing that I think, I mean, is potentially interesting is that since your divergence starts, like, one higher, I mean, it's... You will get the logs in the not in the dimensions. You get the logs for the entanglement entropy. So you might be hiding there like some kind of F kind of like equivalent of anomaly coefficients. But now you will get the log in the say three-dimensional case.
Yeah, three-dimensional.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I mean that would be very super interesting. But I think the only thing is that we have the tools to answer that. Only in Einstein gravity at the moment, because we don't have like corner terms and the boundary terms of null surfaces and blah 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 in higher curvature theories. And I think all these numbers are going to be probably proportional in that case. So you will not be able to distinguish say different central charges at the moment. If you wanted to, then you would have to make some extra work in working out say the corner terms and so on. In higher curvature scenarios.
Can you also do this for fermionic Gaussian states, or like finding a free fermion instead of free bosons?
So we didn't do it, but I think you can find similar circuits that do that as well. And I think it's supposed to be quite straightforward generalization. And one interesting thing to check there. would be if the prefactor is indeed proportional to the central charge, because you saw that in the holographic result there was a central charge factor. So I mean, now we don't know. Maybe it doesn't know the role, but it would be interesting to see if that guy, I mean, is proportional to the
central. Because then you're talking to compare the pink fermion boson with a factor of 1/2 for central charge, for example, then it can.
Yeah, that's super. That would be very, very interesting.
And is there any reason to do this? I mean, is there any motivation to do this for mixed state, like Gaussian thermal states?
Yes, absolutely. So, so one thing that we are doing at the moment with the same collaboration plus Rob and Ro and and Jens, is that we are looking at two copies of a free scalar field theory in the thermofield double state, and we are trying to see if we can extract some extra data which is, say, related to holography. So one thing that we are looking or trying to look there is the complexity of formation, so the complexity of this state compared to the complexity of, say, two copies of the vacuum, starting again from an unentangled product state in the two copies. And that seemed to be proportional to the entropy, like it is in the holographic case, with a prefactor which is a bit different as a function of the dimension. But okay, it should be taken into account that it's not the same theory. I mean, it's a free theory, so we're not expecting just universal behaviors to be similar. But and another thing that we see there is that if we start time evolving the complexity, well, it seems like we have the impression that it saturates very fast, like much faster than you would expect from holographic theories, which is probably also due to the fact that it's a free. That seems to kind of saturate at order one over the temperature or something like that in time, and not exponential in the entropy or whatever.
And you can do this whenever there's a Gaussian state. That's a broad message. As long as the same Gaussian, you can do this analytically.
So, well, I can tell you just that the things that we are thinking about at the moment are like, well, you already said most of them, but we are also, one thing that we would very much like to understand better is the complexity of interacting field theory, at least in a perturbative expansion. And there has been some work by Jordan Kotler and collaborators in which they talk about CNERA for interacting fields in like some kind of, I mean, I think they have something coming out about a perturbative expansion, like having a generator of CIMERA, but in a perturbative expansion in creation and annihilation operators and so on. And so one thing that one would want to understand is if one can define the complexity also in say weakly interacting scenario, whether our definitions would be good enough, do we need to change our understanding of the metric, of the distance function, and so on. And yeah, well, that's more or less it.